If the science is bad, isn't the associated worldview bad as well? Dr. Ray Bolin exposes the impotence of Darwinism today on Probe.
Darwinian evolution has been described as a universal acid that eats through everything it touches. What Daniel Dennett meant was that evolution as an idea, what he called Darwin's dangerous idea, is an all-encompassing worldview. Darwinism forms the basis of the way many people think and act. It touches everything. What Darwin proposed in 1859 was simply that all organisms are related by common descent. This process of descent or evolution was carried out by natural selection acting on variation found in populations. There was no guidance, no purpose, and no design in nature. Therefore, evolution is described as the common descent of all organisms by mutation and natural selection and is assumed to be able to explain everything we see in the biological realm. This explanatory power is what Dennett refers to as Darwin's dangerous idea. Darwinism assumes there is no plan or purpose to life. Therefore, everything we see in the life history of an organism, including human beings, derives in some way from evolution, meaning mutation and natural selection. This includes our ways of thinking and the ways we behave. Even religion is said to have arisen as a survival mechanism to promote group unity that aids individual survival and reproduction. Well, since evolution has become the cornerstone of the dominant worldview of our time, those who hold to it would be expected to take notice when somebody says it's wrong. A growing number of scientists and philosophers are saying with greater confidence that Darwinism, as a mode of explaining all of life, is failing and failing badly. One of the biggest stumbling blocks is evolution's repudiation of any form of design or purpose in nature. Even the staunch Darwinist and evolutionary naturalist, Britain's Richard Dawkins, admits, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So no one denies that biological structures and organisms look designed. The argument is over what has caused this design. Is it due to a natural process that gives the appearance of design, as Dawkins believes? Or is it actually designed with true purpose woven into the true fabric of life? Darwinian evolution claims to have the explanatory power and the evidence to fully explain life's apparent design. This week we'll explore some of the mounting evidence from biology that there are fairly stringent limits to how much organisms can change.
This has been Probe with your host, Dr. Ray Bolin. Get your free copy of Ray's transcript, The Impotence of Darwinism, and find out just how crippled and unfit Darwinism has become. Go to probe.org. Then join us next time as we reclaim and proclaim the truth, God's truth, here on Probe.
It's assumed by most that evolution makes possible almost unlimited biological change. However, a few simple observations will tell us that there are indeed limits to change. Certainly, the ubiquitous presence of convergence suggests that biological change is not limitless, since certain solutions are arrived at again and again. There appear to be only so many ways that organisms can propel themselves through water, over land, or through the air. The wings of insects, birds, and bats, though not ancestrally related, all show certain design similarities. At the very least, various physical parameters constrain biological change and adaptation. So there are certainly physical constraints, but what about biological? For essentially every trait, although it's usually harboring some variability, there's always a limit. Whether the organisms or selected traits are roses, dogs, pigeons, horses, cattle, protein content of corn, or sugar in beets, selection is certainly possible. But all selected qualities eventually fizzle out. Chickens don't produce cylindrical eggs. We can't produce a plum the size of a pea or a grapefruit. There are limits to how far we can go. Some people grow as tall as 7 feet, and some grow no taller than 3 feet. But none are over 12 feet or under 2. There are limits to change. But perhaps the most telling argument against the usefulness of artificial selection as a model for natural selection is the actual process of selection. Darwin called it artificial. A better term would have been intentional selection. The phrase artificial selection makes it sound simple and undirected. Yet every breeder, whether of plants or animals, is always looking for something in particular. The selection process is always designed to a particular end. If you want a dog that hunts better, you breed your best hunters, hoping to accentuate the trait. If you desire roses of a particular color, you choose roses of similar color, hoping to arrive at the desired shade. In other words, you plan and manipulate the process. Natural selection can do no such thing. Natural selection can only rely on that variation that comes along. Trying to compare a directed to an undirected process offers no clues at all. Most evolutionists I share this with usually object that we do have good examples of natural selection to document its reality. Well, we'll look at a few well-known examples tomorrow. It should have been instructive when we had to wait for the 1950s, almost 100 years after Darwin, for a documentable case of natural selection, the famous peppered moth. The story begins with the observation that before the Industrial Revolution, moth collections of Great Britain contained the peppered variety, a light-colored but speckled moth. With the rise of industrial pollution, a dark form, or melanic variety, became more prevalent. As environmental controls were enacted, pollution levels decreased, and the peppered variety made a strong comeback. It seemed that as pollution increased, the lichens on trees died off and the bark became blackened. The previously camouflaged peppered variety was now conspicuous, and the previously conspicuous melanic form was now camouflaged. Birds could more readily see the conspicuous variety, and the two forms changed frequency depending on their surrounding conditions. This was natural selection. There were always a few problems with this standard story. What did it really show? First, the melanic form was always in the population, just at very low frequencies. So we start with two varieties of the peppered moth, and we still have two forms. The frequencies change, but nothing new has been added to the population. Second, we really don't know the genetics of industrial melanism in these moths. We don't have a detailed explanation of how the two forms are generated. And third, in some populations, the frequencies of the two moths changed, whether there was a corresponding change in the tree bark or not. The only consistent factor was pollution. So the most well-known example of evolution in action reduces to a mere footnote. Even Darwin's finches from the Galapagos Islands off the coast of Ecuador tell us little of large-scale evolution. While the finches do show change over time in response to environmental factors, hence natural selection, the change is reversible. The ground finches do interbreed in the wild, and the size and shape of their beaks will vary slightly depending if the year is wet or dry, and revert back when the conditions reverse. Once again, where's the real evolution? There are many other documented examples of natural selection operating in the wild, but they all show that limited change is possible, but that there are limits to change. No one, as far as I know, questions the reality of natural selection. The real issue is that examples such as the peppered moth and Darwin's finches tell us nothing about evolution. While most evolutionists will acknowledge that there are limits to change, they insist that natural selection is not sufficient without a continual source of variation. In the neo-Darwinian synthesis, mutations of all sorts fill that role. These mutations fall into two main categories, mutations to structural genes and mutations to developmental genes. I will define structural genes as those which code for a protein which performs a maintenance, metabolic support, or specialized function in the cell. Developmental genes influence specific tasks in embryological development and therefore can change the morphology or actual appearance of an organism. Most evolutionary studies have focused on mutations in structural genes, but in order for large-scale changes to happen, mutations in developmental genes must be explored. But we'll come back to these developmental mutations a little later. Most examples that we have of mutations generating supposed evolutionary change involve structural genes. The most common example of these kinds of mutations producing significant evolutionary change involves microbial antibiotic resistance. Since the introduction of penicillin during World War II, the use of antibiotics has mushroomed. Much to everyone's surprise, bacteria have the uncanny ability to become resistant to these antibiotics. This has been trumpeted far and wide as real evidence that nature's struggle for existence results in genetic change or evolution. But microbial antibiotic resistance comes in many forms that aren't so dramatic. Sometimes the genetic mutation simply allows the antibiotic to be pumped out of the cell faster than normal or taken into the cell more slowly. Other times the antibiotic is deactivated inside the cell by a closely related enzyme already present. But all of these mechanisms occur naturally, and the mutations simply intensify an ability the cell already has. No new genetic information is added. The great French evolutionist Pierre-Paul Grasset, when speaking about the mutations of bacteria, said, "What's the use of their unceasing mutations if they do not change? In some, the mutations of bacteria and viruses are merely hereditary fluctuations around a median position. A swing to the right, a swing to the left, but no final evolutionary effect." Evolutionists have basically assumed that the well-documented processes of microevolution eventually produce macroevolutionary changes given enough time. But tomorrow we'll explore the natural limit between these two forms of evolution. The fundamental question which needs addressing is how we have come to have sponges, starfish, cockroaches, butterflies, eels, frogs, woodpeckers, and humans from single-cell beginnings with no design, purpose, or plan. All the above-listed organisms have very different body plans. A body plan simply describes how an organism is put together. So can we discover just how all these different body plans can arise by mutation and natural selection? This is a far bigger and more difficult problem than antibiotic resistance, a mere biochemical change. Now we have to consider just how morphological change comes about. The problem of macroevolution requires developmental mutations. We somehow have to change how the organism is built. Structural genes tend to have little effect on the development of a body plan. But the genes that control development and ultimately influence the body plan tend to find their expression quite early in development. But this is a problem because the developing embryo is quite sensitive to these early developmental mutations. So, to sum up the current dilemma, significant morphological change requires early developmental mutations. But these mutations are nearly universally disadvantageous. And microevolution, despite its presence in textbooks as proof of evolution, actually tells us precious little about this evolutionary process. If these developmental mutations that can offer an actual benefit are so rare, then macroevolution would be expected to be a slow and difficult yet bumpy process. It can produce no great or sudden modifications. It can only act in short and slow steps. So the type of mutation is a problem, but so is the rate of mutation. Susumu Ono points out that it still takes 10 million years to undergo just 1% change in DNA-based sequences. The emergence of nearly all the extant phyla of the kingdom Animalia within the time span of just 6 to 10 million years can't possibly be explained by mutational divergence of individual genes. Along the way, functional organisms must form the intermediate forms. Stephen Jay Gould, the late Harvard paleontologist, asked, "But how can a series of reasonable intermediates be constructed?" Well, with his usual flair, Gould asks a penetrating question. There do indeed appear to be built-in limits to change, and maybe intelligent design becomes increasingly appealing.